since I'm a chemist, I could look at the ingredients. There have been products which have presented themselves as organic, and it wasn't just a case that there wasn't a raw material that came from organic agriculture. It's simply the fact that there was not even a natural ingredient in it.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-driven communications agency Higginson Strategy, and I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you. Your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Now, natural and organic have been hot trends for many years in the cosmetics industry. However, amidst a surge in demand, dishonest business practices have been increasing, undermining consumer trust and integrity within the industry. On today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Mark Smith, Director General at the International Natural and Organic Cosmetics Association, or NATRU, and co-chair of the British Beauty Council Sustainable Beauty Coalition. Organisations like NATRU are at the forefront of advocacy for transparency and authenticity in cosmetics. Since its establishment in 2007, NATRU has been instrumental in shaping the landscape of the cosmetics industry, providing consumers with a trusted benchmark through its internationally recognized label. Mark, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Tell us about your journey to where you got to today.
Thank you very much, John, and thanks for having me. So, I'm now the Director General at NATRU, so I'm more in charge of basically the day-to-day management of NATRU, but I'm also involved in the areas of advocacy. And previously, when I started at NATRU, I was involved in the more kind of, let's say, label side of things when we were dealing with regulatory and scientific affairs and the development of our private standard for third-party certification. But basically, I guess my journey starts really as being a chemist. Back in the 90s, I was doing chemistry undergraduate at York, moved forward to do a PhD in chemistry at Nottingham, split between genetics. Then I went to work at Leeds and Montreal to do more kind of scientific research, working in combinations of biotechnology and biomedical work. And then I was just looking to have a kind of a change into, let's say, more of an applied science, something which I could use those same, I guess, analytical thinking skills and apply that to something which was more real world than in the lab. So I'd applied for a position at NATRU, and I was then working under the previous director, Julie Terrell, to basically provide her with support in the advocacy side of work at NATRU, but also, like I say, in the development of the label criteria, which also involved looking at emerging and evolving legislation here in Europe and internationally. So I guess really I've transitioned from being a straight up chemist through to like more, I guess, in public affairs and general management. So quite a change.
Yeah. So we don't normally have so many guests on with such a scientific background as you've got there, which is really interesting. But public affairs is something certainly that the communications agency that I founded Higginson Strategy works on. So just tell us some of those specific examples of some of the ways that NATRU helps organisations to prevent greenwashing.
Well, I mean, NATRU, from its foundation, is essentially established by a group of companies operating within the German, Austria, Switzerland region, commonly referred to, at least here in the EU, as the DACH region. And they were looking for representation to basically advocate for an official regulatory definition of the terms natural and organic in black letter law. And this led them to try and push for representation through the associations which they were already part of. But they felt that they needed to have something specific and specialised, which represented and would advocate for directly the needs of the sector. So even back in 2007, there was a lot of problems with greenwashing. Wasn't perhaps as sophisticated as you might see it now, but like the focus was still that there was greenwashing happening on the market. And there was also an opportune moment because NATRU, at that time, there was also the development of what we now see as the European Cosmetics Regulation. So a transition away from the previous Seventh Amendment to the directive in the Cosmetics Regulation. So what they wanted to do, and I guess how we've been helping people, is in two ways. One, from the perspective of, we started as an advocacy organisation. So there's the straight up advocacy and public affairs for an official regulatory definition of natural and organic and better regulation in that respect for the cosmetic sector, principally to begin with those two claims. It's now expanded to be more general environmental claims, I would say, as there's been more and more characteristics that people have been looking at. But in order to also protect those product, what ultimately end up being product claims, we've also been doing work to protect a wide palette of raw materials for the natural and organic cosmetic sector. And you might say, well, why would we do that? That seems maybe a step apart. Well, the fact is that if you don't maintain a wide palette of natural or organic raw materials that are appropriate for end use in finished cosmetic products, you essentially can reduce the diversity of product categories that can be available to the consumer. But hand in hand with that kind of more advocacy approach, we've also been doing an aspect of developing label criteria, which essentially acts as a business card to embody the ethics and values of our members into criteria that can be basically presented on pack to allow the consumer to have confidence and reassurance in the product that they're buying is what it says it is. So in other words, we're looking at developing a standard that allows for third-party certification of finished cosmetic products and raw materials to give consumers reassurance when they see the label on pack. They know that that product has been validated. It's not just the manufacturer making a self-declaration about what they've, what they say that the product is natural or organic.
How prevalent is it that companies are making claims that aren't true?
There was a report by the EU Commission back in 2016, and it had about 90% of claims were verified, which you could argue, therefore, it's only 10% of products on the market. And the UK was a member of the EU at that time, which would be, let's say, unsubstantiated. The thing is that when you look at 10% of the market, that's still thousands and thousands of products. When you look at the case that product claims like natural and organic are not defined, so therefore how you would actually provide a survey to identify what precisely a natural and organic claim is and when it's validated is also fairly nebulous, fairly like vague. Mm. But I think one of the most interesting ones is if you look at a recent study in 2020 that the Commission did on a Eurobarometer, there was a case that about 50% or so of product claims across all sectors, which I think about maybe 17% were cosmetics, had basically misleading claims associated with environmental 50%. Aspects of a product.
And also you say 90% have been verified, but we all know from, you know, such as looking at documentaries such as Seaspiracy, that very often these labelling bodies do very little of their own research, and largely it's just a matter of paying the organisation, making a self-claim, paying them the money, and you get that mark on your product. That's the case, isn't it, really?
There's absolutely a case where, and this is part of in that same recent EU report, is that, and this is why there's a clampdown on this happening in the EU, is because this basically ends up being a proliferation of labels or iconographic claims, and there's not the capacity of the average consumer to distinguish between what is essentially a self-declaration, like a label that the manufacturer has generated and placed on pack, a kind of third-party verification system along the lines of what you've just said, where essentially it's a pay-to-play system, and you basically just pay for the right to use whomever's intellectual property. And then there's third-party systems which essentially work on more of an in-depth validation process, where you're having, a bit like ours, a combination of a documentation check and an on-site audit. And the reason why that's done is basically to validate that the characteristics that someone says that they're doing on paper, they are actually doing in practice. So, and obviously there are at least three there, which can create a problem for the consumer, yeah, because then the average consumer can't really distinguish between those three types of systems. And therefore, it can lead to distrust, basically, or so the risk of distrust.
Well, I'm glad you're doing the on-site audits, because the other two clearly aren't worth the paper they're written on. Give us an example of some of the most outlandish greenwashing claims that you've seen.
I can say an outlandish claim that I've seen, but I guess the biggest ones that are the most blatantly obvious are ones where I've been to some trade shows, and they're major international trade shows, and there have been products which have presented themselves as organic. Now, since I'm a chemist, I could look at the ingredients, and it wasn't just a case that there wasn't a raw material that came from organic agriculture. It's simply the fact that there was not a raw material there that was natural. So I'm not really sure how they validated that claim at all. They were probably the most obvious. There are some which are more subtle and work along the case of just having like one or two ingredients in there that happen to be, natural, where the claim is anchored on the properties of one or two ingredients. That's quite a common aspect. There are problems with references to some ingredients, but the biggest one I've probably seen is where it suggested the whole product was organic and it had not even a natural ingredient in it.
I think that goes to show that true verification processes like you have there at Natru are really so important. And as you say, so difficult for the consumer to know which ones are right and which aren't. There's so many different labels for so many different things. So it's great that the EU is legislating for this. And as you say, as you said earlier, Mark, you said we in the EU, you're carrying out this interview from Brussels, aren't you?
That's correct.
You're based there.
Yeah, that's correct. So Natru has been based here since 2007. Yeah.
So just tell us about communications. Have you had in your career what you feel are any really good communications wins?
I guess some of the, it depends whether we focus on the communication of what. I mean, if we look at communication of our label, some of the major wins have been the case that the general awareness, principally amongst manufacturers, and through, like, let's say, consumers who are aware of labels in the major markets. So in Europe here, that happens to be like sort of France, Germany, Italy. We've certainly seen, like, I think that's I don't know whether I describe things as major wins because they always tend to be like kind of transitional. But I certainly take, let's say, comfort in the fact that there's been increased awareness within the major markets of the Natru label. But I mean, those are, if I also think about like in terms of just general communication, I think the fact that Natru as an organization has become more well known, and not just for its label, but also for the work that we're doing within the institutions, either being invited to various working groups and the development panels of standards, being part of the European Commission's working group on cosmetic products and being able to voice for the industry there, providing feedback to any type of public consultations and doing the advocacy and lobbying work here in Brussels. I think it's been a case where the association is quite small relatively, but I feel that we hit above our weight, particularly as the secretariat is only half a dozen people.
Well, definitely seems bigger. Tell me about where you get your own news from and what you listen to or read or watch.
Yeah, I mean, well, personally, I like anything that goes from like, your tech to the music or what have you. But I guess if I'm looking for news feeds, I mean, there's the standard news outlets. If you're going through the BBC or CNN or what have you, I mean, these type of things tend to come up on just generic feeds. But I also quite like the more independent news that you might get through YouTube or podcasts. just to get different points of view on subjects. I mean, if I think about, that's more, I guess, in my personal life, but if I think about more in my work life, there's a combination of just general print media to podcasts like the one we're on, and they can be podcasts run by independent individuals through, you know, public affairs and PR agencies, or they can even be through institutional agencies, like, for example, ECHA run podcasts, or other, like, basically EU institutions. So it's a combination of things. I think it's really important to have a very balanced aspect when you're reading information and getting subject information, so that you don't live in a kind of hermetically sealed bubble and an echo chamber.
Yeah. And what do you do to relax?
Like I say, I'm a big fan of music on these things, and particularly like playing music. So I play the drums and the guitar. I can't play the drums much in my house, but I can certainly play the guitar to relax.
And what kind of music is your, what's your favourite genre?
I like to play a lot of jazz guitar, or also like 60s folk music, just more for the finger picking and the melodies, really. I used to just play Oasis when I first started.
Did you? Nice easy chords there, are they?
Yeah. Exactly.
Great. Are there any failures you've had in your career that you've thought at the time, God, I could have done that a bit better?
I think, when I was in the lab, it's always a case that we used to say that there should be a journal of negative results, because it's probably the most informative thing that you could find is learning through failure. So failing experiments, not having like thought out the rationale, not set up an appropriate roadmap to experiments, I think started as early as when I was doing my PhD 20 years ago or something. But if I think about the work now, I mean, there's also learnings that you have, anything from dealing with members, dealing with other colleagues, and also from an advocacy side. You know, as I said, I've got a chemistry background, so coming to the advocacy side and realizing that there's a change in pitch and delivery and how you're, like, let's say, selling an argument, failing on that and entering too highbrow or too emotional was also like a learning curve that I think was also important to become accustomed to. But thankfully, as long as you like hold the mirror up to yourself every so often, I think you get past that point. But they're probably like, I don't know whether they're major failures, but they're certainly like points of learning where I had, you know, a proper moment of reflection.
Dr. Mark Smith, Director General of NetTrue and co-chair of the British Beauty Council's Sustainable Beauty Coalition, thank you for speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose. If you'd like to know more about how Higginson Strategy supports purpose-led organisations, go to higginsonstrategy.com.